cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up the cloud he drove.
This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with Western Short Stories. Today we'll be reading again from Talking Leaves, Contemporary Native American Short Stories. This book was edited by Craig Leslie and published in 1991 by Delta Trade Paperbacks in New York City. I remind you that our stories are sometimes edited for recording. Our first tale is entitled After Celillo by Ed Edmo. I'm not sure what it was that caused my going. Maybe youthful exuberance. I'd like to think it was the quest for knowledge and creativity. Lightning was my guide, and the moon was my protector as I stood by the road, sticking my thumb out to the world. It was the spring of 1964, when all of the glories of high school football were over, and there was only the dull future facing me. As I looked at the Columbia River, I remembered the many times I had gone there. The river was a welcome friend that never had to be called in for supper. Celillo Falls attracted white tourists, tourists in baseball caps, straw hats, pith helmets. Some were bald-headed. Tourists came to the falls to watch Indians fishing off of scaffolds. Tourists with sunglasses hanging from their sunburnt necks, their knobby knees bulging from beneath Bermuda shorts. They handed us silver quarters to pose with their children and their grandchildren. I liked to get next to a little white girl. If she was afraid, I'd move closer to her, and when she would get tears welling in her eyes, I'd reach out and grab her and giggle. You know, being next to a real Indian is a really frightening experience. The river was calming. I'd watch the soothing current and see the sun reflect off the silver waves. In 1957, the government built the Dalles Dam and flooded us Indians out of our traditional fishing places. We didn't want to be flooded out, but they called it progress. I remember that they held meetings in people's houses. Then we Indians would talk about our future and wonder what would happen to us. It was a hard time. My father had seen the plans at the Dalles Chamber of Commerce, and he tried to warn people at Celillo. But the people only teased him and called him an old Chinaman because my father didn't wear braids like the other Indian men of the village. When the engineers began leveling the earth to make a new right-of-way for the Union Pacific Railroad, the Indians of the village saw that the government meant to do as they had planned. Many remembered that when Bonneville Dam was built in the 1930s, the Herman Creek Indians were forced to move, but not compensated for any of their fisheries or their homes. My father organized the Indians at Celillo Village to meet on a regular basis. We didn't want the government just to move us out and not compensate us for any of the fishing or our houses. My father wrote to Senator Neuberger of Oregon, who introduced a bill in Congress to have the government pay us for our fisheries and buy us new houses. At the time we were negotiating the amount of the payment, the chief's son said, "You should pay us $50 for every board in our drying sheds, because this is our way of life." The government man got angry and told us Indians that we should accept their fair offer, and that if we didn't, he would go to the judge at Wasco County and have our land condemned and bulldoze everything without paying us anything. When the workmen finished surveying at the end of the day, some of us boys would pull out the stakes from the ground, fill in the holes, and make a small fire out of the stakes. Others would climb the cliffs and shoot BB guns at the big dump trucks as they hauled dirt. We would laugh when a driver stopped his truck. In our own small way, we tried to stop the dam. Finally, when we were moved out, we had to burn our house. I had to choose what to take and what to leave to get burned up. Just as Dad started the fire, I ran back into the house to get my bedside stand. It was an old commode. Later, I was to get it refinished, and it became an antique. We watched with mixed happiness and sadness as the old house went up in flames. We were to get a new house across the river. We moved into an all-white community, Wishram, Washington. After a year of fighting, my brother and I were accepted into school. One time a little white girl got mad at me for some reason. She spit on me and told me to go back to where I came from. I couldn't go back because there was a freeway where my house used to stand. I couldn't understand why she said that. I grew up in tough times. I learned to escape into books, and I knew the library. I was not hurt by the characters in the books. I could pick and choose from a world that accepted me and didn't put me down because I was an Indian or came from a poor village. It was bright sunset as I stood on the north side of the Columbia River, and a blue car stopped. "How far are you going?" a young man asked. "Portland," I said hopefully. "Get in," he said. He handed me a cigarette. The car ride was filled with country and western music and chit-chat. We crossed the Hood River Bridge and drove west. He said that he was only going as far as Cascade Locks. I was glad for the ride. He dropped me off at the freeway exit. "Good luck," he exclaimed. "Thanks, man," I replied. The sun had set and it was almost dark. I began to get scared. A cop might be looking for a runaway from a small town. Headlights shone on me as a car pulled over. I saw it was a pickup. I got to the side. I peered in, and a tall black man sat behind the steering wheel. "Get in, kid," he commanded. I hesitated, but he asked wearily, "Do you want a ride or not?" I got in, and we made small talk until we got to Portland. He drove me to the east end of the Burnside Bridge, where the transients and homeless stayed, and dropped me off. "Walk across the bridge, kid, and you'll find your people," he said it matter-of-factly. I thanked him and began walking across that bridge. And that was After Cililo by Ed Edmo. Now we'll read The Humming of Stars and Bees and Waves, this by Anita Andreese. Long ago, there was a spirit woman, and her name was Yamamuli. She made the earth. The rippling grasses gone swaying into the wind, the scarlet mountains floating in clouds of tiny blue birds. And the day was divided into astonished animal faces, and the night was a fountainhead of stars and a slumber of river turtles. Since that time, the papery husks of stars have fallen into the seas, and mothers have grown older. Rosa is a woman who talks to herself. Although she doesn't remember the first creation, she does remember the birth of her only child, a son named Natchez. She made the people and put them in a village, and in the middle of the village was a talking tree that hummed like bees. When Natchez was little, Rosa talked to the coyotes and ravens and flowers, but now she is old and can't see very well. "I wonder," she thinks, "if my dreams can tell me how to make my eyes better." She knows that her tribe believes in dreams, but since she's half Yaqui, she doesn't know if the dreams believe in her. Still, she begs for a dream that would speak healing words. The tree spoke a sacred language. No one could understand it. Not the youngest, not the wisest, or bravest, or strongest, not even the oldest. Rosa wakes one morning and remembers a dream that tells her to enter a cave. Grandmother Spider Woman tells her to bring cedar, tobacco, and corn. No walkie-talkie, no flashlight, no strings or breadcrumbs to mark the path, just blind faith. And so, when the moon is yellow and the mist low under the dark apples, when the fields are gold and dry with rows of stars shining on the tassels, when the horizon is lilac and the mountains to the west are blue-black, Rosa ties the bag with the offerings around her waist and hikes up the trail to the old caves. The caves are usually there, but legends have it that they sometimes disappear. Rosa is not sure what to expect, so she mutters to herself as she walks, The back of her neck is hot and sticky, even though the air is cooling and rising from the valley. The trail gets steeper and narrows to one foot in front of the other. She puts one hand on her knee in order to propel herself forward on the steepest parts, and prays the rest of her will follow. "Damn stupid thing to do," she mumbles. She's a little worried about bears, even though one of her husbands had been a bear spirit. That's how she saw her men. This one a bull, that one a Saint Bernard. At least talking would scare away a bear now. She is too old for such foolishness. Finally, she rounds the curve of the mountain. Her heart is beating fast. The cave opens in front of her like a huge, toothless mouth. She can feel the cold, musty air push out toward her. The floor of the cave is rough, littered with angular rocks. She's a small woman with bony knees and with one shoulder slightly higher than the other, but her skin is surprisingly smooth for her age, and her hair is still thick. She waits until her heart calms down. Then, pretty soon, it's getting dark outside. She might as well go in. "I hope I know what I'm doing," she thinks. She walks with her hands stuck out in front of her. She can hear water rushing to her left, a swift stream. "Don't let me die in here," she prays. When Yama Muli returned from her creating, she shook off the images of shimmering feathers and jungle greens and small monkey faces and loosened her fingers from speckled granite and purple-spiked sea urchins and brushed off the coral sands from her memory and listened to her children. They were worried. They had been given something sacred and had not understood it. Some argued that the holy is never understood. Rosa listens. The stream has a voice and it chants, "Earth Bowl," and "Dusk Womb." The walls have a voice that says, "Terracotta Hands," and "Eyes of Clay." Rosa feels the presence of tiny spider women sitting with their spindly legs crossed. Minerals drip drip, funnels of teeth like spikes, vaginal and wet. The spider women undid their thousand eyes and reach out, sticky fingerlings, silken threads slivering the cracks of deeper darkness. The threads anchor on Rosa, the outworlder. The voices are those from the void. Terra Marina, Terra Noche. In Rosa's ears, she hears the bull roar and raw rushing out of a water drum. "My own body is full of minerals," she thinks, "and thousands of her cells echo the stratification of the earth. She isn't lost." Yama Muli pulls her cheek to the talking tree and listens to the humming voice. Rosa is a stone woman. She is a stone fish swimming through a river of turquoise, a half-blind fish, funny and leaping to the rhythm of a shadowless current. When she was a young woman, she liked men. She still likes men, but none of them will look at her. When she was young, she needed a cane to walk sometimes. Her sight was good. Now it's cloudy in one eye, and life's so lame that she doesn't need a cane. Often, life is beyond understanding to her. There's more than blood in her veins now. There's a longing for more life, more stories, more kisses. She remembers her own grandmother who lived alone for 46 years after her husband died, celebrating his birthday with flowers in front of the silver-framed photo, with yearly visits to the cemetery. Now, Natchez has a baby, and Rosa sleeps alone, her husband of 30 years, dead for some time. She remembers his nightly whispers to her before they fell asleep. One of his favorite sayings was, "Life has no guarantees." Yama Muli heard what the tree was saying. She turned to look at her people and spoke, shrugging a cloud from her shoulder. "I'll tell you what the tree says, but you must promise to believe me." Rosa trips and falls to her knee. There's blood and a sharp pain. "Shit," she moans. She feels old, old as the clay shards in the lap of earth, old as the curled fetus shapes in red clay graves, skin wrinkled over thin ribs and around faces of grief. Terra Recepta, corpus terra. I'm not crazy, she repeats to herself. I'm here for a reason. I know what I need, to see, but not how to do it. Inching forward, her knee throbbing, she feels the walls narrowing. The stream widens into a pool. She can hear the stillness in the center and the rushing out near her feet. The spider women throw a ball of moony webs up into the air, and a soft light fills the caves in her heart. So, now, what do I do? Asks Rosa. Do you believe in us? Click the spider women. Of course, and so the people listened. The tree told the animals how to live, that the deer should eat grass and the puma eat deer. Then it spoke about the future when men from a far country will come and everything will change. There will be new laws and new death, and a great metal snake with smoke plumes will race across the land. When the people heard this, they became afraid. Being half Yaqui isn't easy, Rosa thinks. You have to believe the trees and rocks and birds talk, and you have to have faith in glass-walled elevators and voices that are transmitted from space. Then there's pantyhose that assumes your shape and dreams that struggle to shape your awareness. Long ago, Rosa got real tired of shape-changing, being Indian with Indians and white with whites. As she got older, she became less afraid and howled like a coyote in heat whenever she damn well felt like it. From the ceiling of the cave, tree roots hang down in a gnarled nest. The cave seems to be breathing. I believe, whispers Rosa. But some didn't believe Yomamuli, so she left, with her favorite river rolled up under her arm, walking north, her feet like two dark thunderclouds. Rosa thinks about her white mothers, their names rolling off her tongue like pearls. Jean, Anne, Johanna, Maria, Barbara, Anna, Margareta, Elizabeth, Susie, Juliana, Anna, Orsola, Felicita. And her Indian mothers, Estefana, Charlotta, Empamina, and others whose names were lost, unwritten, but remembered in a certain flash of eyes. Names of grandmothers who still sing in the blood. Rosa feels grandmother's eyes all around her. She sees with their eyes. She sees the pond, its water clear as air. The elements are transmutable. And some of the people went to live in the sea, their whale songs tubular and roiling, boom echoing deep in the interior seas of their throats, longing and sounding all in a moaning song, floating up to the spume moon. Rosa turns to the cave walls. Clay. She pulls a chunk out and rolls it in her hands, forming a ball. Little clay baby, cave navel, lodestar, and mother lode. She pinches it into a rough bowl. With her thumbs, she shapes it, smooths it. Quickly, she fills the bowl with pond water. A sip. It tastes like metal and semen and breast milk. It is sour and sweet and musty and white and black and red and yellow. And some became flying fish, ringing the waves, sparkling. And others became the singers of the sea, with their long hair and rainbow skin. They say if you're lost at sea, these creatures will help you because they remember the time when we were all one. Rosa unties her bag of offerings and puts the tobacco in the bowl, the cedar chips to the right, the corn to the left. Fumbling a bit, she pulls out a book of matches and carefully lights the tobacco. A thin, hand-like shape of smoke rises. She thinks of her family. She thanks her guardian spirits. She thanks her own strength. She thanks the Creator. The grandmothers sing, ebb and return, web and wheel, smoke and water. The void has wings. We sing and reel. Spinner and spinal songs, spiraling, symphonic and symbiotic. Sightless but full of visions. We grandmothers, we dreamers. The singing stops, and Rosa gathers the strands of webs into a little ball. She puts it into her weak eye. The tobacco has burned itself out. She lights the cedar chips. No fire, but sweet and piercing. Then she scatters the corn on the floor. Her inside is blooming. It is becoming a way of seeing. Sparkling eyes, whirlwinds of nerves, a visible cortex, quartz quadrants, four corners of wind and gates into seeing. She crosses the earth, she crosses the sky. And some of the people descended into the earth and became jointed, jet black or red. These little ant people who live in the sand will also help you if you are lost. She took the clay bowl and pressed it back into the cave wall. For they also remember the time when we were all one. Rosa stands and feels the darkness fall around her, but she can see. Her white moon eye, her shedded snakeskin eye, her winter-worn leaf eye. Gone the thickening curtain, gone into the thoughts of the spider women. In and spin, filaments of eyes. There are cedar trees floating in the air, and the faces of those she has loved waver delicately in front of her. She is seeing with her heart. She feels the pain burning away. It's the pain of learning to let go. Que sera, sera. Sierra Rose is the name of the daughter she never had. Let go. Her husband's hands hugging her in the morning. Let go. Her little son saying, I'll always stay with you. Let go. Herself thinking, I never want another friend. They'll leave or die and it hurts too much. Let go. Let go. Her eye is clear. There is no division between the worlds of seeing and believing. Rosa is ready to leave. She knows there is confusion outside and the noise of cars honking in the night. But there are also stars with no room for self-pity. Rosa ties a lace on her Reeboks and turns around. Those who stayed in the village grew taller and taught their children how to face the future. She walks quickly toward the cave entrance, which has a lesser denseness of dark. Then she sees the moon seeping out of the fat wheat heads. It's full and yellow. In the valley, she hears the cottonwoods shaking under the force of their water-filled roots. The bees are sleeping, dreaming of heavy black clouds booming over gold-white fields and sheet lightning flashing into a hot and crinkly air. And the ravens are dreaming of circling in a chicory blue sky. Twirly seeds of yellow starbursts fall in floating circles to the earth. Rosa feels the circles growing inside her, as if she were a tree of immense dawns. Taking a deep breath, she smiles to herself, thinking of her son and her new granddaughter. I'm not useless, she says firmly, and I'm not alone. As she brushes the dirt from her clothes, she spares one last look at the cave. Its darkness, its blindness, had terrified her. It was the blindness of death, the conception of nothing. Now she begins the way back. In the distance, the sky is luminous with the lights of the city, a city that may turn into thin air, for it also remembers the time when we were one. And the people who live there are like enchanted trees, with bones for branches and eyes for leaves. If they listen, they can hear the humming of stars and bees and waves. These are my ancestors, my future. And that was The Humming of Stars and Bees and Waves by Anita Andreese. Now we will read Going Home by Joseph Bruchak. Look, Tommy, down there in the valley. Look at all those little houses. Look at how they are all like little boxes, those houses in that little town of theirs. They always like to build in the valleys, those white people. The new Ford van rolled along the thruway as Jake Marsh pointed with one long brown finger out the window, the Indian accent coming out from between lips held carefully, unmoving. The half-smile of trickster was on his face, a can of ginger ale in his other hand. Behind the wheel, Tom Hill shook his head and laughed silently. Yes, Tom said. Yes. Ooh, Tommy, look, maybe there's a college in that town. Yes, there is a college there. Maybe it's the college where Sonny is going to school. We're always sending him money at the school. He's been in college for a long time now. 12 years, Tom said, coughing. He always writes to us for money. He's a good boy. He's doing well in the college. Someday, we will go and see him. All of us will go and see him. If he ever tells us where the college is. All of us, Tom said. All 120 of us. Yes, Tommy. We will go for his graduation ceremony and have a giveaway. We will give away many blankets. Then he will come home. They say at the agency they have a good job for him. Janitor. That'll be a good job for an Indian boy with a college degree. He will have vacation time with pay. Retirement benefits, Tom said, keeping his face straight. Tommy, you know he has a girl at the college, but he won't tell us about her. I think maybe she's white. Yeah, she is white. Yes, with a little boy, about 6 years old now. She's on the East Coast now, too. She's up working for notes. Uh-huh, Tom said. He lifted his hands on the wheel and pointed with his lips at the sign that read, Rest Area. Jake shook his head and they passed the turnoff without slowing down. There wasn't anything for us in that prison, Tom said. It was so far out in the desert it cost wives and girlfriends more than $30 just to come and visit. It was called a rehabilitation center, a training center. For rehabilitation, they would have us dig holes, then fill them up again. And for training, they had us build walls, long stone walls. They looked like the Great Wall of China, except they were only about 3 feet high, the walls we built. They had us build them at the base and up the side of the mountain that rose behind the prison. That mountain was beautiful. It was the best thing there. You could feel its breath blowing over the camp. But there was nothing for us inside Fort Grant, especially for the Indians. So we asked to be allowed to have a sweat lodge. There were sweat lodges in the other prisons, but none at Fort Grant, even though we had more than 20 Indians, and we all knew we needed it. Damn. Right rear tire, Jake said. Tom pulled the van over to the side of the road. The flat tire went wathot, wathot on the pavement and then growled into the gravel. Both men got out and stretched. They walked up the side of the grassy bank and sat down. It was a crisp day in early September. The air was sweet to breathe as the taste of well water. Jake leaned on one elbow to look closely at a small plant. It says I should pick it, he said. Your uncle was a medicine man, Tom said. He looked at the plant. They were both smiling, but Jake pulled the small plant up and wrapped it in his handkerchief, leaving a little tobacco on the ground where a few grains of gravel had come up with the roots. They walked back to the van and began to change the tire. They worked with the slow ease of men who had spent years doing that sort of thing. When they were done, they spat, wiped their hands on the seats of their jeans, and got back in. Jake sat behind the wheel. He started the engine. What did you do next? He said. He slipped the van into gear. First, we did it their way. We went to the prison chaplain and asked him to be our sponsor. There was only one chaplain for all faiths. Methodist, Baptist, Catholic, Jewish, Mormon, even the black Muslims. He was a Catholic priest from Boston, Father Malley. So thin, we used to say he was scared to cross his legs for fear he'd cut his knees. Father Malley said it was not possible. That's when Harold Buffalo spoke up. Sir, he said, there's going to be a sweat lodge here. When something like that is going to happen, you can't stop it. Did they interpret that as a threat? They interpreted that as a threat. Tom smiled and looked out the window. 10 miles, he said, reading the sign. First they thought of transferring him out. Then they thought maybe that was what he wanted them to do. He'd asked to be transferred from Fort Grant twice before and been refused. Finally, they decided to restrict his privileges and not let him take rec with everyone else. Harold didn't mind, though. He started running by himself every day. First he ran a mile, then he ran 2 miles. By the time they decided it hadn't been a threat and let him back into population, he was running 10 miles a day. He'd been a Green Beret and knew a lot about survival in the desert. Maybe that's why they were worried about him. Everybody in Arizona remembered the fox. "I heard about the fox in Nevada," Jake said. "Another Green Beret." He escaped from Florence. He was in for killing 4 men, 2 of them police. He knew they'd never give up on trying to catch him, but he didn't even try to get to Mexico. He just stayed out in the desert near the prison. Nights, he'd sneak into the camps of the men hunting him and steal food. He even climbed back over the wall into the prison and left his calling card for them, right where the captain would step in at the next morning. It took them a long time to catch the fox, but they say they finally did. Trapped him in a box canyon and shot him to pieces. But none of the prisoners ever saw his body. Some say he just stayed out there or finally did make it to Mexico. So they kept a close eye on Harold because they remembered the fox. But all he did was just run, faster and faster every day, around and around inside the fence. Tom pulled out a pack of Camels and shook 2 cigarettes loose. Jake took one, then lit both with his lighter. The smell of the tobacco was strong. Blue smoke filled the inside of the van. Jake jerked his head to the right and Tom nodded. They pulled off onto the exit. A state police car was parked near the toll booths. Tom opened the glove compartment and slid the automatic pistol out without looking at it, his eyes held straight ahead. He put the gun between his legs and covered it with his red handkerchief. They stopped at the toll booth. Jake smiled at the 40-ish woman with dark hair in the booth. She looked as if her feet hurt, but she smiled back. "Hi, Chief," she said. "Indians get to use this road for free, don't they?" Jake said. "You tell that to the people at the other end when you got on?" she said. She showed her teeth in a wide smile. "That's a nice ring you got there. Make it yourself?" "They didn't give me any ticket, and I did make the ring. You like it?" "I like turquoise. Blue's a good color." She waved them on. "Have a nice day." They turned onto the 4-lane that led into the city. "I think," Tom said, "the state cop in that car wasn't really sleeping. I think he was watching which way we were going."
"They aren't stupid these days," Jake said. "I'm sure he saw us take 81 South, right?"
"Right. No one is following us, though." Jake looked into the rearview mirror. He swung the blue van to the left, crossed over the divider in the center of the road with a bump, swerved, and steered back into the northbound lane. He took the next exit. It led to the smaller road, which bypassed the city.
"Unless they already got a chopper watching us, we're okay for a while," he said.
What happened next, Tom said, was that one morning Harold Buffalo was just gone. They found his pillows stuffed under his blankets. Even the bloodhounds couldn't pick up his scent. They looked everywhere for him and couldn't find him. He was gone that day and all that night. But the next morning, when we looked up to the top of the peak above the prison, just at dawn, we saw the light of the fire and the smoke rising. It took them most of the morning to get up there. They found him sitting in front of the fire, just where he sat to pray and greet the dawn. "It's a good day," he said. Then he said, "There is going to be a sweat lodge at Fort Grant." Tom leaned out the window and looked up, then back. "All clear," he said. He took 2 more cigarettes from his pack, lit both, and handed one to Jake.
"Niawe," Jake said.
Everybody had seen that fire of Harold's, so now reporters had come from Tucson and they'd seen the smoke, too. So the guards hardly beat Harold up at all before they brought him back down and took him to the warden. When he got to the warden's office, Harold told the man he knew how to get out any time he wanted to. He could get out without anyone seeing him. He could teach other people how to do it, too.
In fact, there were already 19 others who knew how to do it. That was what he told the warden. Then he told him they needed a sweat lodge. 3 days later, we had our first sweat lodge at Fort Grant. They were on a little highway on the other side of the city now. They turned onto an even smaller winding road which led down through the hills. On all sides the vegetation was thick. A rabbit ran in front of them and Jake slowed the blue van down. A raccoon walked across their path. To their right, a roadside dump sprawled. Car bodies and garbage were piled by the roadside.
Indian recycling station, Tom said.
He took the crushed ginger ale can from the litter bag and tossed it out. It spun through the air and bounced off the cracked enamel side of an old GE refrigerator. If I was a state cop, Jake said, I'd set up a nice little roadblock at the edge of the reservation. Maybe around the next corner where this runs back into the state road. He pulled the blue van off the road and put on the emergency brake. Tom took the duffel bag out of the back of the van and slung it over his shoulder.
Well, they won't have to look far to find this.
He patted the blue van.
So long, Big Blue, he said.
They're going to catch us, Jake said. He'd picked up a long stick from the roadside. He was whittling at it carefully with a big knife he had taken from the sheath at his side. The turquoise ring glinted with sunlight as his hand moved with small, quick strokes, and the keen edge shaved off curls of wood.
Not before we get to the mountaintop, Tom said.
It was impossible to see his eyes behind the dark glasses, but Jake knew they were black and hard and laughing.
Yes, Jake said. It is good to go home.
And together they walked into the trees. And that was Going Home by Joseph Bruchac. Now we'll read Elizabeth Cook Lynn's story, A Visit from Reverend Tyleston. 50 miles from the nearest town of any size, deep in the bend of the Missouri River where the Dakotapi had made history for generations, lived the family. Father, a firstborn son whose eyes bore the immutable and unspoken agony of his generation, handsome and strong, a cattleman not so much from choice as from necessity. Mother, a fine quill artist, small-boned and stout, a woman with one crooked elbow caused by a childhood accident. A good cook, accomplished at the piano, guitar, and harmonica, talents she had learned at the government boarding school. Uncle, the mother's younger brother, a truck driver sometimes, a drunk increasingly often, whenever those inexplicable waves of grief washed over him. Grandmother, grandfather, and 5 children ranging in ages from 3 to 15 years. Uncle's son often lived with the family, as did the grandmother's half-sister and her husband and their 2 granddaughters. The family was part of a small community which had reassembled itself at this place after the violent diaspora and displacement that was endured by this ancient tribe for several generations. The family all the more closely knit because of this tragedy of recent history, as well as the more practical problem of long distances to the few sparse surrounding towns settled 100 years before by whites anxious to possess land and become rich. The year was 1935, and this was a place where strangers, though alien and undesirable, even called Doka, were largely unthreatening and often ignored, and where stranger events were witnessed with inexplicable but characteristic tolerance. From the graveled road which followed the course of the river, the small 3-room frame house in which the family now lived, built by the U.S. government for Bureau of Indian Affairs employees in early reservation days and abandoned in later times, looked strangely remote and ageless. It seemed to stare listlessly toward the river's loop, and in winter, its long-windowed eyes would be the first to catch a glimpse of the landing of the Canadian geese on the cold shores of the whitened, timeless river. It turned its base on the ludicrously inexpedient pyramid-shaped, steel-roofed ice house, which had once afforded Bureau employees from the East the luxury of iced drinks in the summer as they came to this blistering Dakota prairie to work, all in the Indian service. The ice house was abandoned now, although too big and deep to be of any use to the family, except for the summer drying of the pounded meat and berry patties, wasana, which would be laid out upon its roof in the sun. During this drying process, the children would be set to fanning the flies away with long willows, a task which held attention a surprisingly brief time. Bored, they would run off in pursuit of more imaginative pastimes, only to be called back as soon as grandmother discovered their absence. Also at the rear of the house was a large teepee, the color of smoke at the top, streaked with rain, lined with cow hides, comfortable, shaded in late afternoon by the lone pine tree which was, itself, a stranger to the hot plains country of the Dakota, itself a survivor of the days when Bureau employees lived there. The children imagined that the tree was brought there by a medicine man and was used in his cures, but it was not a cedar, just a scraggly pine tree which had barely survived hard times. There was a tall hand pump set in the middle of the yard where grandmother would kneel to wash the paunch during butchering, and also a corral set some distance away in the tall pasture grass at the foot of a small rise in the prairie landscape. A huge mound of earth covered a man-made cave which was complete with wooden steps and a slanting door which had to be picked up and drawn aside. A very large bull snake often found refuge from the blistering sun under one of the wooden steps, stretching himself full length in the soft, cool, black earth. Just beyond the cave was the small white outdoor toilet, another survivor of former times, a product of imaginative public health service officials who set about dotting Indian reservations with these white men's conveniences during the early part of the century. Across the road from the house, a gray stuccoed Catholic church, St. Anne's, sat with a closed, tight-lipped visage as though shielding itself from the violent summer prairie storms which came intermittently, pounding the gravel in the stucco, flattening the prairie grass. To the rear of the church lay the remains of the ancestors in a cemetery which, years later, was said to be occupied by a den of rattlesnakes. In summer evenings, the air was often still and quiet, heavy with moisture. After a late meal, the quiet deepened. The only sound was grandmother's soft footsteps as she went back and forth to the kitchen, carrying dishes from the table. Her ankle-length black dress hid her bowed legs, and her head was covered always with a black scarf, her long white braids lying on her breast. Every now and then she stopped to wipe her smooth face with a white cloth. "Grandmother, we should cook outside tomorrow," said the youngest daughter, disheveled and hot, bearing a load too heavy for her, to the kitchen. The mother simply sat, one arm outstretched on the table, the crooked one fanning her face and hair with a handkerchief. For her, it had been a long day, as she and her sister had spent the afternoon picking wild plums and buffalo berries along the river. As the evening came on, the children could be heard outside, running and chasing one another around the house and yard, trying to touch each other on the back, stretching away, laughing, now and again falling and crashing into the bushes near the pump. The dogs barked loudly. It was a game the boys never seemed to tire of, even as the sun started to glow in the west, and Uncle went outside to begin his nightly summer ritual of starting a smoke fire, a smudge, to keep the mosquitoes away for the evening. "Oxila kintuktel un hay," muttered Uncle as he looked around for one of his nephews to help him gather firewood. "He's never around when you need him. Go get some of that wood over there by the back porch." He directed his voice toward the hapless youngest daughter, who wrinkled up her nose, but went dutifully to get the wood. Uncle bent down on one knee to place the sticks and dead leaves just right to produce a heavy smoke. He carefully touched a match to the soft underbrush, and as the smoke rose, he watched, one thumb hooked in his belt. In a few moments, smoke filled the air, and members of the family began to gather for the evening. They might even see man being carried in the sky, thought Uncle. And then he could tell a story if the children felt like listening and could stay awake long enough for the stars to show themselves clearly. When he straightened up, he was surprised to see a small black sedan some distance down the road, making its way slowly toward them. He kept his eyes on the road to see if he could recognize in the dusk who its occupants were. He stepped upon the porch and lit a cigarette, the match illuminating the fine, delicate bones of his deeply pocked, scarred face. Holding the match close for a moment, Uncle said, to no one in particular, "A car's coming." Cars were rarely seen on this country road this late in the evening. As Uncle stood watching, he heard church music, faintly at first, and later, blaring, and he realized, after a few long moments, that it was coming from the loudspeaker positioned on top of the sedan. "Onward, Christian soldiers," sang the recorded voices of an entire church choir into the quiet evening light as the car came slowly into the river's bend. "With the cross of Jesus going on before." Uncle stood with the cigarette in his mouth, his hands in his pockets, as his brother-in-law came out of the house and sat down on the porch step with a cup of coffee. They watched the car approach and listened to the music, now blaring loud enough to get the attention of the children, who stopped running and stood gazing at the strange-looking vehicle. They stood transfixed as the car approached slowly and came to a stop. The loudspeaker fell silent as the driver of the sedan parked the car on the side of the road near the mailbox and, with great cheer, stepped from the car, waving and smiling. He was a man of about 40 with a broad, freckled face. He was perspiring heavily, and he made his way down the short path from the road to the house. Behind him came two women dressed in blue, white flowered dresses, brown stockings, and flat brown shoes. Their faces, like pale round melons, were fixed with broad smiles. They all carried black leather-bound Bibles, the kind with red-tipped pages. "Boy, it's hot," said the 40-ish freckled man as he held out his hand in greeting. The father did not look at him, nor did he get up. He put the cup to his lips and sipped coffee quietly, ignoring the intrusion with sullen indifference. Uncle kept his hands in his pockets, and with his tongue he shifted his cigarette to the other side of his mouth. Ignoring what was clearly a personal affront by the two men on the steps, the freckled man said, "Say, that's a good trash-burning operation there," turning to the children standing beside the smudge. The children looked first at the smudge and then back at the perspiring man, and silently they shook hands with him. Grasping the unwilling hand of the youngest daughter standing a few feet away, the man, in a loud voice, asked, "Is your mommy home, honey?" Nearly overcome with embarrassment, she said, "Yeah, she's in there," and gestured toward the door. "Well," the man said as he turned and walked up the steps slowly, avoiding the father and the uncle, still mutely positioned there. "We've come a long way with a message of hope and love we've got right here," and he patted the black leather-bound book he carried. As he tapped on the screen door, the mother appeared, and the freckled man quickly opened the door, stepped inside and held it open for the two smiling women who accompanied him to squeeze inside and in front of him. "I'm Sister Bernice," began the plumper of the two women, "and this is Sister Kate." Her voice trailed off as if she had asked a question. When there was no response, she turned to the freckled man and, putting her hand on his elbow, she said, "And we're here with Reverend Tileston." Taking a deep breath, the Reverend said to the mother in his kindliest voice, "Ma'am, we'd like to pray with you." And there in the middle of the room, he knelt and began paging through his Bible, motioning for the women to join him as he knelt. His two companions quickly dropped to their knees, and the plump one said to the mother, "Please pray with us, sister." And the mother, after a brief, uncertain moment, also knelt. Espying the grandmother and her half-sister peering at them curiously from the kitchen doorway, the Reverend quickly got up and led them to the middle of the room, saying, Come on with us, Granny. Pray with us. And the two old women, too, with great effort, got to their knees. The youngest daughter, having followed the astonishing trio into the house, stood beside her grandmother and looked expectantly at the perspiring, freckled man as he fell to reading from the leather-bound book. With all our energy, we ought to lead back all men to our most merciful Redeemer, he read. His voice rose. He is the divine consoler of the afflicted. Youngest daughter hung her head, copying the attitude of the visitors. To rulers and subjects alike, he teaches lessons of true holiness. The reverend sucked in air. Unimpeachable justice and, he breathed again, generous charity. The reverend's voice seemed to fill the cramped little room, and sisters Bernice and Kate, eyes tightly closed, murmured, Amen, louder and louder with each breath the minister took. Youngest daughter glanced first at her mother, then her grandmothers, who were kneeling shoulder to shoulder, faces impassive, eyes cast to the floor. Then, the reverend closed the book, raised his arms, and recited from memory. Proverbs. Hear, O children, a father's instruction, he shouted. Be attentive that you may gain understanding. Yea, excellent advice I give you. My teaching do not forsake. One of the dogs, hunching self close to the screen door, began to whine. The reverend continued to shout. When I was my father's child, frail, yet the darling of my mother, he taught me and said to me, Let your heart hold fast my words. Keep my commands. Do not forget. Go not astray from the words of my mouth. His arms fell and his voice softened as he uttered the last phrase, opened his eyes and looked unseeing at the little girl, his gaze moist and glittering. The dog's whine became more persistent, his tone now pitched higher to match the reverend's, and he began to push his nose against the screen door, causing it to squeak loudly. The Reverend Tyleston looked into the passive faces of the mother and the grandmother, and he said, The beginning of all wisdom is, get wisdom at the cost of all you have. His arm swung dangerously close to the unfortunate dog, who flattened his ears and pushed himself closer to the door. Get understanding, Reverend Tyleston urged. Forsake her not, and she will preserve you. Love her, and she will safeguard you. Extol her, and she will exalt you. She'll bring you honors if you embrace her. She'll put on your head a graceful diadem. A glorious crown will she bestow upon you. The words seemed to roll from his tongue, and youngest daughter imagined shining crowns placed upon the heads of her mother and her grandmother, still kneeling stiffly and impassively. She was thrilled with the sound of the English words, though she knew she didn't comprehend their meaning. It was like the time when Felix Middletent, the well-known Dakota orator, made his speeches at the tribal council meeting she sometimes attended with her father, when he used his most eloquent and esoteric Dakota vocabulary, oftentimes derisively referred to by uncle as jawbreakers. As the reverend's hefty arm again swung about the room, the whining dog lurched backward and fell against a large pail of buffalo berries which mother had left on the porch that late afternoon. Terrified, the dog leapt into the second pail of plums, scattering them wildly. Then he dashed under the porch where he set up a mournful howl. The boys who had been listening at the side window fled into the bushes, laughing and screaming. The mother and grandmothers, surprised and shocked at this turn of events, but bent upon retrieving the day's pickings, swept past the astonished, speechless minister, shouting abuse at the now thoroughly miserable dog, and the screen door slammed behind them. Youngest daughter was left looking into the disappointed faces of the reverend and his companions. She smiled. Forced by these circumstances to admit that the spiritual moment was lost, the Reverend Tyleston got to his feet and ushered sisters Bernice and Kate out of the house, carefully picking a path through the berries covering the porch. He was relieved that the father and uncle were nowhere to be seen, and he turned at the last step and made a final effort, saying, "Meditate, mothers, on the scriptures. Have knowledge of them, for they are the food which sustains men during times of strife." The women, engrossed in saving the berries, didn't hear him. His final proselytizing gesture, the attempted distribution of printed pamphlets, was also ignored. Their composure now completely shattered, the trio which bore God's word into this obscure bend in the river found its way, falteringly, to the sedan, switched on the loudspeaker, and drove slowly away. Youngest daughter looked after them as they ventured deeper into the curve along the river, and the faint echo of, "With the cross of Jesus," rang in her ears. After a moment, she went to find Uncle, who would tell her a story about the Star People and how the four blanket carriers once helped him find his way home from a long and difficult journey. She hoped that the Reverend knew about the blanket carriers. And that was A Visit from Reverend Tyleston by Elizabeth Cook Lynn. Thank you for joining us today as we've read Western short stories from Craig Leslie's book, Talking Leaves, Contemporary Native American Short Stories. This has been Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
An old cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plow through the ragged sky, and up the cloudy draw. Aye, yippee-i-ho.
If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org, left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then, under Programming Links, left click on Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device as well.